pills can be forgotten. Condoms have an 18% failure rate. You can get pregnant during your period, and research shows that 75% of 17 to 25-year-olds have had sex without the use of contraception. I'm Jess Redden, and I'm a newly qualified pharmacist. I'm passionate about young people empowering themselves with the right medical information they need to make the right decisions for their contraceptive and sexual health. In this four-part series, My Contraception and Sexual Health, supported by Bayer, I talk to four healthcare professionals to learn and to share with you what we need to know about our hormones, sexual health, and contraceptive options as young adults. Contraception hands us our sexual freedom, provided we know how our bodies work, choose the right contraceptive option to match our needs and protect ourselves from sexually transmitted infections, which is why we created this series, and you can find further information on mycontraception.ie. The opinions shared in this podcast are those of the individual healthcare professionals and are intended as general information only. It is not intended to replace a consultation with a healthcare professional, nor is it intended to provide specific medical advice. Always speak to your doctor or nurse for personal medical advice. When it comes to our reproductive and sexual health, our hormones are in control. In this first episode, I'm joined by Dr. Caoimhe Hartley, a GP with a special interest in women's health, to learn more about our female hormones, their impact on our body, and how we can best care for and support our hormonal health. Hello, and thank you for joining us. My name is Jess Redden. I'm a newly qualified pharmacist, and today I'm so happy to be chatting with Dr. Caoimhe Hartley, who founded the Menopause Health Clinic in 2021. Caoimhe is a wealth of knowledge, and today she's going to share all her knowledge and expertise with us on the topic of hormone health. So firstly, Caoimhe, thanks so much for speaking with me today. I'm excited to pick your brain. So I suppose to get started, could I ask you to describe exactly what a hormone is?
Sure. Yeah, great to be here chatting to you about this. So thanks a million. That's a bit of a big question to open with, isn't it? Like, it's so broad, and it's hard to maybe kind of put it into a nice little soundbite. But basically, hormones, they're chemical messengers that we have. And there's loads of different types, and they have loads of different actions. And they're a messenger molecule. So they circulate in our bloodstream, and then when they get to a target organ or a target tissue, they then exert an effect on that target organ. So that's what hormones are.
That's an excellent explanation. And then what role do the different sex hormones play in the body of, say, a 17 to 25-year-old female?
Okay, so again, kind of complicated, but basically, if you take a step back and look at the way that our reproductive system works, so you can start at the top. So we have our brain, obviously, and you have your hypothalamus, so part of your brain that secretes a particular hormone, and then there's this kind of domino effect. So that hormone that comes from your hypothalamus, it has an impact on a different part of your brain called your pituitary gland. And your pituitary gland is about the size of a pea, tiny little gland, but has a really, really big function. And it secretes all these different hormones, some of which actually control your ovaries and how you ovulate and how other hormones from your ovaries are then produced. Your pituitary gland actually produces hormones that influence how our thyroid works, how other parts of our body work as well. So it's kind of your master gland sitting up there, you know, pulling all the strings, calling all the shots. And then there's a feedback mechanism. So your ovaries, they ovulate, they produce an egg once a month when you're in your reproductive life, which most women from the age of 17 on are. And those hormones that your ovaries produce, so there's three, there's estrogen, there's progestogen, and there's testosterone. And they have a feedback mechanism. So they kind of loop back and have an influence on how your pituitary gland works as well. So this is kind of talking going on, this communication, a conversation's happening basically between your pituitary gland and your brain and your ovaries, going back and forth and back and forth the whole time, trying to maintain this kind of nice rhythmic balance from month to month of reproduction, of your reproductive cycle.
And is there anything that can kind of offset that balance?
Yeah, lots of things can. So, I mean, sometimes disease processes, so there's certain conditions that can have an influence on how this kind of balance and conversation that happens between your pituitary gland and your ovaries, and that nice kind of, like I said, that sort of cycle that happens month to month, that can be knocked off by things like certain conditions. So things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, there's diabetes, thyroid conditions, lots of other things can have an influence on that. Sometimes medication, it's actually part of how some of our contraception works, is by interrupting this conversation that's happening between the pituitary gland and the ovaries. So there are other medications that can have an influence on that too. But outside of, you know, disease or pathology or medication, just stressors in your life. So being under acute stress, exercising, so having increasing your exercise, and severe weight loss. So there's other conditions too that can interrupt how your pituitary influences your ovaries, and it can actually affect how your ovaries function. And so you might stop ovulating, and so you might stop having periods or having a reproductive cycle because of other things in your life, like weight loss, like stress. Even acute bereavement, I've seen, can really have this negative impact. It shows how sensitive we are to external factors when it comes to reproduction. And it's kind of a protective mechanism, I think. I think your body's sort of tuning into the fact that maybe, look, maybe this isn't a great time to become pregnant. And so it, you know, it sort of dampens down ovarian function and ovulation and your chances of becoming pregnant.
That's an excellent way to describe it. If your body's too stressed, of course, you can't look after, you know, anything in your womb. But I suppose it's important for women to understand if they're not getting a period, there's so many factors at play. Like you mentioned, stress is a big one. So is it true our cortisol then increases and that switches off our pituitary glands? Or how does that work with the stress?
Yeah, it's probably a bit more complicated than that. But you're right in the kind of basic way of how it works. Absolutely. All these hormones, like the way I was saying, well, look, you know, your ovaries produce these hormones and they feed back to your pituitary. But actually other things like thyroid, cortisol, which comes from your adrenal glands, which sit just on top of your kidneys, they're often seen as your stress hormones. And they wax and wane over a 24-hour period. But all these different hormones, even things like insulin, which is produced by your pancreas, which is a hormone that we associate with things like diabetes, all of these hormones talk to each other. So as they circulate around in your bloodstream, they're having an effect on other glands that are producing other hormones. And there's this kind of really delicate interplay that's going on with all these hormones. We're really complicated. Like as creatures, we really are very complicated. And hormones are really interesting, I think, because they don't just have an effect on their one little area. Yeah. They're kind of bouncing off each other the whole time. And so your reproductive cycle is this kind of connection between your brain, your ovaries, your womb. But it's also listening to other parts of your body and how healthy you are and how those other parts are functioning as to whether or not it is a good time to become pregnant or, you know, and how they function in general can be influenced, yeah, by other hormonal factors too.
I suppose you have to take kind of a holistic approach to it rather than just focusing on, okay, I need to get, you know, my estrogen and my progesterone in balance, but you need to look at your thyroid hormones and your other hormones as well. You mentioned thyroid hormone before. What kind of role does that play in the body?
Okay. So when we're talking about our thyroid, so the thyroid is a gland that sits in your neck, and it's an interesting sort of butterfly shape. So it's got two lobes, a left and a right side. And it sits just underneath your Adam's apple, if you're male. And it produces thyroid hormone, but it is under the influence of your pituitary gland as well, which produces a hormone that sort of tells your thyroid gland how much thyroid hormone to produce. So your thyroid then produces this hormone, thyroid hormone, that regulates our metabolism, our metabolic rate, your heart rate, digestive function, brain function, even bone metabolism, and like how much your bone, how quickly your bone turns over can be influenced by thyroid hormone. So it has this kind of far reaching effect on all these different organs, but it, similar to other parts of your body, you know, it has this feedback mechanism too. If you have too much thyroid hormone floating around in your body, your thyroid gland picks up on that and your pituitary and your brain picks up on it. It sort of reads, that takes a kind of reading from your circulation. It decides, oh, we've a bit too much. And so it tones down how much it's stimulating your thyroid gland and your thyroid level drops. And you're constantly, your brain is so clever, like it's constantly adjusting to how much of this hormone you have circulating around, but it can go out of whack. So there are conditions. So, you know, genetically, sometimes people are predisposed to developing a condition with their thyroid gland or to developing an underactive or overactive thyroid gland. Certain viral infections, autoimmune diseases, other things like that can affect how it functions. And that sort of delicate balance gets knocked off skew. You produce too much or you might produce too little. What's really interesting from my perspective, because I do so much women's health, is that it's part of our workup for things like fertility. But even women who have who are having irregular periods or whose periods might have stopped and they don't know why, you include things like a thyroid level for those women, because we know that if you're underproducing your thyroid hormone or overproducing, that can actually knock off your reproductive cycle. So they're all, there's an interplay. It's all kind of communicating with each other.
That's very interesting. So what would that look like if someone did have, say, too much thyroid hormone? What kind of signs and symptoms would that?
Yeah. So if you're overproducing thyroid hormone, think of it as kind of stepping on your accelerator pedal in your car. So you're ramping everything up. So psychologically, people often feel a bit anxious. They might feel a bit on edge. They might feel almost kind of shaky. Your metabolic rate can speed up. So you can see weight loss. You can see a change in hair growth. And again, you might get things like diarrhea. You might get palpitations. Your heart rate can speed up. The things that you can't see that are happening in the background, if it's left untreated, we can actually see changes in your bone density long term. So there are all these kind of changes that are happening in your body. And what's interesting is with the thyroid, that the exact opposite is true if you're underproducing. So it's like taking your foot totally off the gas pedal, so to speak, and everything slows down. You know, you can get constipation, your heart rate slows down, you can feel very sluggish and tired, dry skin, dry hair. And you might find that you're putting on weight when you didn't previously without changing something in your lifestyle. So for no kind of apparent reason. And again, it can affect things like bone density and your overall well-being. In vulnerable populations and sometimes in older populations, if they're underactive, if their thyroid's not producing enough hormone, we can actually see things like depression and a change in cognitive functions. So all of these hormones seem to kind of just do their little thing in isolation. But they're really interesting and they're all really important in their own right.
Well, it's important to realize that they're all interconnected as well. Like you were saying, you know, sometimes it's a markup now for work that they'll check your hormone levels so you can correct the hormone levels. And then perhaps, you know, that will improve then your reproductive hormones as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think like women are fascinating. If you look at kind of puberty, when we hit puberty, a hormone from our brain kicks in. It's kind of genetically on its timer and it kicks in and it sort of kickstarts this whole process that gets this kind of, I'm looking for the right word, but like cycle is probably the wrong word, but it gets this process in action, this sort of system of like almost like a cogwheel system inside of. Exactly. Yeah. Think of it like it's almost like machinery. Yeah. And so you see, you know, your pituitary gland starts to spit out hormones and then your ovaries sort of respond to that and they start producing an egg once a month and they produce their own hormones like we discussed. And then that has an impact on on the lining of your womb. So that's the kind of reproductive side of things. What I would see most commonly in girls kind of from 17, from kind of puberty onwards, really, is that they can run into trouble with things like, you know, periods that are maybe too heavy or too frequent or periods that have stopped out of the blue. And then we talk about things like fertility and other symptoms that are kind of connected to this reproductive cycle and the hormones that are produced as part of that. And it's teasing that apart and sort of picking it apart to see, well, where has the problem happened? At what level? Is it at the womb level? Is it at the ovarian level? Is it in your brain? And then working back from that again to find out, well, why has it happened? So it's really interesting. It's really challenging. It's really individual, but it is really, it's definitely not boring. Premenstrual syndrome is a really interesting one to bring up because it is, I think, gaining recognition in the last little while, which ties in. I'm going to go off on a total feminist rant here about how, like, traditionally, you know, normal things in our menstrual cycle and abnormal things in our menstrual cycle were often dismissed, you know, medically. And like with fertility and menopause and all these other things, women were told, you know, this is just part of normal life, get on with it. I have, if I go back, so I'm a GP a long time. And if I go right back to the beginning of, you know, when I first like entered the general practice world and was seeing patients, it shocked me the number of women who came in with debilitatingly bad periods. Like, I can't function. I can't leave the house for a couple of days, or I can't do that sport I love, or swimming, or whatever it was, or the pain was just so severe. And they'd just been told for years, this is normal. Like, oh, you're just unlucky, you've bad periods, but it's normal. And so kind of a get up and get on with it kind of approach, which is wrong. I mean, it's not necessarily due to disease, but it doesn't mean you just kind of put up with it at the same time. It's also really distressing. I think a lot of patients, a lot of women are distressed by it. Why am I so different to my sister or my neighbor or my friend who doesn't have this problem? Am I doing something wrong?
And that actually physically impacts on your life. Like, I think it's important to open up the conversation so women don't feel so alone and trying to hide those feelings. You need to just, is there anything that women can do to help with
tons? And I think you're absolutely right. The first thing is to take a step back and say, okay, this isn't, like, whether it's normal or not normal, it's not working for me. Like, my, it's having an impact on my quality of life. And it's defining what is PMS versus, which is premenstrual syndrome, versus premenstrual dysphoric disorder, like you pointed out, which is PMDD, is a very difficult thing to do. And there's a few different, you know, again, kind of coming at it from the medical perspective, there's a few different criteria that we look for. And there's these questionnaires that are 50 questions long, and you're supposed to tick things and rate things out of 10. Realistically, the easiest way of defining whether PMS or PMDD, the more severe version of that, is an issue or not, or whether you have PMDD, it comes down to the impact it's having on you. Is it stopping you or preventing you from having a fulfilling relationship? Is it having an impact on your relationships, your day-to-day life, your work, you know, ability to be productive and work, your ability to just enjoy things? And is that happening in a repeated fashion? So we all have a bad month here and there, but women with PMDD or with very severe PMS, it's repetitive. It's every month or almost every month they'll have this issue, but it's really impactful. I'm absolutely fine for 2 weeks. Then I'm not feeling great. Then I have a dreadful week where I'm just, everything is awful. I can't function properly or enjoy anything. And it lifts as soon as their period comes. So within 2 or 3 days of starting to get their period, they feel back to normal in inverted commas. And things go on, and that cycle repeats itself. And over time, that gets really, like, it gets very depressing, because you start to get almost, you start to anticipate that mood that's going to descend on you before you have your period. It's really debilitating. And there's loads that we can do. So looking at the kind of what's happening with your hormones, you're right in saying it's progestin. So the first 2 weeks of your menstrual cycle, you are trying to make a follicle, which contains an egg, and you're trying to get one of them to get mature enough that it ovulates and becomes a viable egg to be fertilized. So that process takes about 2 weeks. And while you're doing that, you're making a load of estrogen. And the estrogen thickens the lining of your womb so that if you do have an egg that's fertilized, it will have something to implant into. So once you ovulate, which on average is after 14 days, so you're now kind of mid-cycle, when you ovulate, you then start producing this other hormone, which is called progesterone. And progesterone's main job is to turn that thickened lining into a different type of lining that is very suitable for a growing embryo. Turns it into what's called secretory lining. So it makes it sort of hospitable, a comfy place to land if you're an embryo looking to grow somewhere. But if you don't become pregnant, and your that egg is not fertilized, you start to lose your progesterone over that 2 weeks. Those progesterone levels fall, the lining comes away, and the cycle starts again. And a lot of women, for whatever reason, progesterone, find that when they are producing a lot of their own progesterone in the second half of their cycle, it makes them feel like crap. It makes them feel moody. It makes them feel tearful. They might be irritable. So lots of kind of mood and sort of psychological symptoms. But for other women, there's a lot of breast tenderness and bloating, and you're not yourself. And that big drop of hormones that happens in the last few days can also precipitate a lot of really unwelcome symptoms. So what we do is you can treat it by trying to switch off ovulation. If you don't ovulate in the first place, you're not going to produce progesterone. You're not going to get this massive fluctuation of hormones, and you will feel a bit more stable. That's what the pill does.
Hey. You would recommend, obviously, going and speaking to your GP about this, what hormonal contraception could be an option for someone with PMS or PMDD?
Yeah. So one approach is to come at it from a hormonal perspective. Okay, well, let's stop you ovulating. And that will give this kind of sense of calm, you know, overall. And so that's often achieved, yeah, with the normal birth control pill, the combined oral contraceptive pill. The problem is for some women, that's fine. We stopped them ovulating and they feel better. But the progestin that's in the pill, which is part of how we stop you ovulating, they also feel rubbish while they're on that. So if you think a lot of women out there, I'm sure listening to this, will have some experience of being on the combined oral contraceptive, the normal over the, not over the counter, the normal pill. And they, for a certain percentage of them, they will be thinking, I felt awful. Well, it didn't suit me. I didn't like being on the pill. It didn't suit me. And the reason it didn't suit them is because the pill is a combination of estrogen and progestogen. Most people get on great with estrogen. Our bodies love estrogen. Estrogen is where it's at. It's fantastic. It's real, you feel great on estrogen generally. But that second hormone, progestogen, for some women, there's a pretty high percentage of women who are progestogen sensitive. So you've replaced one problem with another. You've stopped their own progestin production. Fantastic. But you've replaced it with another and they feel rubbish on it. So for those women, there are other options. Maybe a different brand of pill might be different and might help them, a different dose. Because there are, all these different brands of pill will have different doses and different types of progestins. Maybe a progestin or a form of contraception that will stop you having as much progestin in your system. So for some women, we use the coil. Now, it's not as good for PMS, but it can be good for some other things like very heavy bleeding, and it's great contraception. And for women who can't take hormones at all, there are women, even from a medical perspective, if you've migraine with aura, if you've had a blood clot, if you're a heavy smoker and at high risk of blood clot, we might decide, okay, look, maybe the pill is not an option. But we use non-hormonal approaches, and we often use what are called SSRIs. They're a type of antidepressant, and they're not perfect, but they can be really helpful. And for women with very, very, very bad PMS symptoms, they can really help and alleviate some of those symptoms. For the women who are perimenopausal, so maybe a bit older than we're talking about today, but we'll often use HRT, same idea. We're trying to kind of calm the system down. So there's loads of options out there for PMS and PMDD, and even non-pharmaceutical things like cognitive behavioral therapy, obviously looking at diet and exercise and a more holistic approach can be really helpful for some women too. Just depends on the person.
Thank you. Yeah, I find myself definitely, it is cyclical. In the last kind of 2 weeks, I just feel much more sluggish and my skin goes crazy. So I always blame kind of like acne prone skin to progesterone. Would that be, am I right in thinking that?
Probably a combination of progestin and sometimes testosterone. We think of testosterone as being this sort of like it's a man's thing, it's male hormone, we've no testosterone, but actually we make probably 3 or 4 times the amount of testosterone than we do any other reproductive hormone. And we convert some of that testosterone into other hormones. Like we make some estrogen from testosterone. It can be a kind of precursor. And we make it from about half of it comes from our ovaries, about half from those little adrenal glands we spoke about earlier that sit on top of our kidneys. And because we get this gap between testosterone and how much other hormones we're making, and that fluctuates throughout your cycle, we can sometimes see testosterone side effects of things like acne happen more around the time of our period as our estrogen levels drop. And again, that's really genetic and really individual. I had horrible acne in my teens, so I know all about it, yeah.
But it's interesting there. So you mentioned testosterone. So I wanted to ask you, we could do an entire podcast on this. So what is the role of hormones in polycystic ovarian syndrome?
PCOS. So PCOS, or polycystic ovarian syndrome, is difficult, again, it's to pin down because it's quite complicated. And we actually don't fully understand what the etiology, like what the causing underlying factor is. There's a suspicion that it may be genetic, and that certain women have inherited this predisposition to developing PCOS. So it's probably a genetic thing that you're born with. And what seems to happen is that you produce insulin, so not a reproductive hormone that we think of at all, but if you're overproducing your insulin a little bit, it has an effect on your ovaries. And it causes your ovaries to produce too much what are called androgens. The most kind of well-known androgen is testosterone. So this kind of testosterone type hormone. And there's then this kind of knock-on effect. When you're producing too much testosterone, you are less likely to ovulate regularly. And so your periods might become irregular. And you're also more likely to have side effects like excess hair growth, and acne. And some women, but not all, with polycystic ovarian syndrome, if we were to go and do an ultrasound, a scan of their ovaries, we would see cysts growing on their ovaries, hence the name. But actually, the name's really misleading because you can have totally normal ovaries on a scan, but still have polycystic ovarian syndrome because you have some excess hair growth, you have acne, you have irregular periods, you have all the other things. And when we look at your blood results, it's in keeping with PCOS. There's this kind of testosterone type picture. So, I mean, the majority of women with PCOS, and it's about 10% of women, if not more, because it's really underdiagnosed and underpicked up. But the majority of women with PCOS are probably completely, you know, like functioning normally. It's not having an impact on their daily life. Their periods are relatively regular. Their symptoms are not bothering them too much. So most women are in a kind of moderate category, if you like. And then there is a small percentage of women with PCOS whose periods will stop completely or become totally irregular. And they often then are picked up because they go to the doctor, their GP, to have a chat about it. Or you might have women who present because they have very bad acne or what they consider excess hair growth, which we'll come back to perhaps in a sec. And then there's the fertility bit. And it's only a small percentage of women with PCOS who have a difficulty becoming pregnant because they're not ovulating regularly. I think it's really important for women to know, if you are worried that you've PCOS or if you've ever been told that you've polycystic ovarian syndrome, you know, fertility is generally not an issue for women with this. It's only a small percentage. And actually there's loads that we can do about that too. So that's, you know, good to know.
Yeah, really good to know. Would you see a lot of people with PCOS in Ireland?
I think it's somewhere between 10 and 15% is kind of the numbers that they quote. But as I say, that's probably under reported. I'd say that realistically, the figure is probably higher. It can be controversial because the criteria we use to diagnose it are controversial and the guidelines change and they're actually slightly different in some countries than others. But generally speaking, yeah, it's probably 10 to 15% of the population. So it's that would be considered pretty common, to be honest, you know.
And then in terms of, so how can women age, say, 17 to 25 best manage their hormonal health? Like how important, for example, are diet and exercise to our hormones?
I think they're important anyway, in a general sense, because I think, you know, to some degree, you don't have a huge amount of control over what your pituitary gland in your brain and your ovaries are kind of doing. You're just strapped in for the ride a little bit, I think. But going back to kind of the beginning when we'd said, look, you know, times of really bad stress or bereavement or like dieting or over-exercising, that those physical stressors as well as psychological stressors can have an impact. It's maybe worth bearing that in mind and knowing that, okay, like, you know, how we feel, how our mental health is, does probably have an impact on what our reproductive cycle and our hormones are doing. So looking after that is all you can do. You can only look after the bits that are within your control. So having a healthy diet, usually we're talking about sort of a Mediterranean diet, a heart healthy diet, being active, but not stressing your body to a point that you're exercising beyond a level that is comfortable or dieting to a point that you're, again, affecting your health. That will have an impact on your reproductive cycle. So I think that's all you can do. And I think being aware of what's, I don't want to say normal, but I mean, being aware of what's impacting your quality of life and going and talking to someone if you feel, I'm not happy, I think my periods are heavier than they should be, they're really affecting me and I want to do something about it. Or if you're concerned, or things like fertility, if you have concerns, bring up the conversation with your GP. GPs are brilliant in this country. We're spoiled. They're fantastic. They're often very receptive to having a conversation, even with younger women, about future planning, about, you know, and talking about, you know, cervical smear screening and mammogram screening and getting that discussion all to happen early, even for women in their early 20s, I think is really, really important.
It's important to know that obviously both physical stress and emotional stress can affect our hormones. I think we always maybe focus on just the physical side of it, but it's so important as well to just, if you're feeling emotionally stressed, to realize that maybe that's the cause of something that's underlying. So you had mentioned obviously fertility and irregular periods. What would you advise women who do have irregular periods? I know it's really common, and I think women are quite reluctant to seek help or to seek advice about irregular menstrual cycles. Like, how can we best regulate them?
I think the first myth is thinking that your periods should be completely regular. So I'll often have women say to me, I have like really irregular periods. You know, it was 28 days this month, but it was 30 the last month. Like that's actually, that's regular in my head. So, you know, you're not finely tuned enough to the point that we're absolutely the same month on month. So what we would, from a medical perspective, and like having irregular periods would be defined as having periods that vary by a week or more per month. As in, if your average cycle is 28 days, if you then start having a 21-day cycle or a 35-day cycle, that would be considered irregular. So there needs to be a difference of about a week or more each month. We talked a bit about polycystic ovarian syndrome and what we consider to be irregular periods in that kind of context. So having less than 8 periods in a year, in a 12-month period, that's awfully confusing. Having less than 8 periods in a 12-month span would be considered, you know, to be kind of having an irregular cycle. So you'd want, you know, variation of 2 or 3 days month and month is actually pretty normal. So just to put that out there. So don't get too hung up on like the exact, you know, day. And also for some women, their cycle might be, my average might be 24 days and your average might be 32 days. And it's whatever is normal for you. Less than 21 days between your periods or more than 35 might not be abnormal, but is worth a discussion with your GP if that's a thing that's happening you most months or most of the time. So less than 21, more than 35, it's worth a discussion just to make sure there's nothing else going on. So having irregular periods, you know, we usually take a step back. We look and say, well, look, is it hormonal? So is it at the level of, is it that your ovaries are not producing what they should be? Is it that your pituitary gland is not doing what it should? So we start with blood tests. And usually with the blood tests, we're measuring them on day 3 to day 5. So day one is the day you get your period. A couple of days later, or within that first few days, that's the most accurate time to get your blood tests checked. And from a fertility perspective as well, if we're looking at things like menopause or early menopause, or just sort of where you are with that, that's probably your window of time. That's the best time to get those hormones checked too. And look at the overall picture. So we also make sure, you know, have you other symptoms? Have you excess hair growth? Have you acne? Are there other things that we would tie in with being hormonal? You know, have you mood issues? Has there been major stress in your life? Has something else changed? So it's often worth taking this kind of holistic picture to see, is there anything else going on? And then are there other new medications or have you other medical conditions? We check your thyroid. It's worth checking a hormone called prolactin, which is also produced in your brain that can have an influence on your reproductive cycle. So bloods is a good place to start. Sometimes doing an ultrasound, which is a scan to look at your ovaries, and that we're looking for PCOS usually, taking a history and taking, you know, looking at all those symptoms and looking at what's going on in your life. That's the best place to start. How you influence it or what you do about it comes down to what the underlying issue is usually. And if we find no cause and it's just, this is just something that's happening to you, but it's bothering you, you want to regulate it, the hormonal contraceptive pill is probably your best bet. And it will give you a nice, if you want to have a regular cycle, that's probably the best way of achieving that. It also reduces your bleeding a little, which is really handy. And it's birth control, which is great. Or something like a coil. So an intrauterine device releases progestin, which is a hormone, and that can often reduce down your bleeding completely. So it makes you not have as this, you know, this kind of irregular cycle, you know, your period coming out of the blue, so to speak. So there's lots of different options.
And there can be questions around taking hormonal contraception and their impact that they have on the body. Can you address those? Like, obviously you would advocate for them in certain people, or can everybody take it?
No, everyone can't take it. And it often comes down to this discussion about, well, why are you taking it? So what are we trying to achieve? Is it that you want birth control? Is it that you want your periods to be lighter? You're regulating your cycle? Is it just to remove the nuisance of having a period once a month? What are you trying to achieve? And also, what's your medical background? So we look at risk. So we balance up benefit and risk. And for the vast, vast majority of women, the benefit will vastly outweigh the risk, which is good. There are some women who can't take the pill. So if you have a history of migraine with aura in particular, so some women with migraine headaches, they get changes in their vision, which we call an aura. And they, because they're at slightly higher risk of getting a blood clot or a stroke. And if you're taking estrogen by mouth, which is what's in the pill, you're also slightly higher risk of blood clot and stroke. So basically anyone who's carrying an increased risk of getting a blood clot or stroke, it's a discussion about that level of risk and whether or not they're a candidate for the pill. women who have high blood pressure that's not well controlled, same idea, they might not be a candidate for the pill. And there's a few other kind of medical conditions too. And we're careful in women who are on certain medication, like anti-epileptic medication. So it is really individual, but most women are fine to take the pill. And in terms of its impact, I think one of the most common things I get asked is about weight gain, which it bothers me that that's often one of the first questions that people come out with. It shows you how much we're kind of driven by that, how much value we place on it. It's all, I mean, that's, and anyway, that's a conversation for another day, Jess, I guess, isn't it? Like the kind of place of society in all of that, but, and yeah, culture and all the rest. But most of the studies that have been done have suggested that whether any type of pill, the intrauterine device, HRT, all of these exogenous hormones that you might take are weight neutral for the most part. They can give you side effects. We talked about progestin earlier, and that can give you a bit of bloating. And sometimes people feel, because they're bloated in the first month or two of taking it, it makes them feel like they've put on weight. But actually, it's just that they're bloated and they feel kind of crap because of that. You can get some irregular bleeding in the first month or two. So you can get a bit of spotting here and there. That's something to watch out for. Sometimes people find their headaches get a bit worse. So again, something to watch out for. And some people find their mood is affected by the progestin. In terms of risk, younger women on the normal birth control pill, their breast cancer risk is probably unaffected because of their age. And we don't think long-term fertility is affected by taking any type of hormonal contraception, with the exception of some of the injectable progestin. But in general, talking about the normal pill, the intrauterine device, your long-term fertility shouldn't be affected at all. And rates of ovarian cancer, womb cancer, and potentially bowel cancer are actually all reduced by being on birth control.
Is that thanks to estrogen?
It's thanks to switching off ovulation. So if you're taking the normal contraceptive pill, because your ovaries don't have to work so hard, they get to take a break. They're like, I don't have to produce an egg every month, I can sit back. And because the lining of your womb, same deal, doesn't have to turn over once a month, we don't see this room for error. It doesn't have to work so hard. And so your risk of cancer is actually reduced over your life.
Okay, this is very reassuring.
Bonus, yeah.
That was a very informative chat. And thank you so much for taking the time. I think it's important to get practical advice from reputable people like yourself. And the more we open up the conversation around hormonal health, hopefully the more empowered women feel about their health.
That sounds great. I couldn't agree more.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for listening to My Contraception and Sexual Health. We hope that this show has supported you in finding out more about your body and how to select the form of contraception that best suits you. You can find all the information relating to this episode on the mycontraception.ie website. If you think others can benefit from this series, please rate, leave a review, or share across using the social hashtag mycontraception. For further information and support, visit mycontraception.ie. This show is supported by Bayer. If you want to report a side effect or quality complaint for any contraceptive product, please contact your healthcare professional or report them to the Health Products Regulatory Authority via the Bayer.ie website.